Now we're in depth on making the case for climate change to people of faith. If you caught my conversation yesterday with former ambassador and Republican Governor John Huntsman, you heard me ask him why a climate denier like Oklahoma Senator Jim Inhofe is the leading voice of the party on climate science. Huntsman, who does believe in climate change science, said this.
On climate, it seems that we have 90% or more who have said something's happening here and here are the root causes. And maybe we should be doing something about this. I say, as you would in cancer, well, the experts are telling us something. We have a choice. We can either respond to that with policy options and walk the American people through those policy options, costs associated with them, what happens if we do nothing. And right now we're not doing that because the whole issue has been politicized.
But Senator Inhofe often uses his faith to make an argument against climate change.
We keep hearing that 2014 has been the warmest year on record. I asked the chair, you know what this is? It's a snowball. And that's just from outside here. So it's very, very cold out. Very unseasonal. So here, Mr. President, catch this.
My guest was nodding knowingly. She has an answer for Senator Inhofe and for other climate deniers who believe their faith leads them to dispute the science. She's a scientist and evangelical Christian who works hard to meet evangelical deniers and skeptics where they are. We'll talk about what that means. We're also going to talk about why it's so hard to change people's opinions on climate change. And this may be a good place for you to come in. When you get into a conversation with someone who doesn't believe in climate science, do you use gentle persuasion? Do you hammer them with facts? Do you give up and walk away? What works for you? I think we're going to get some good advice from our guest and the conversation today. But I want to know what happens when you get into a discussion about climate science. I mean, is it, do you lay out, well, here's the science and here's the facts and this ought to be persuasive enough? Do you use a little bit of gentle persuasion? Does that work? Talk to us this morning about that. 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. Conversation on our page at nprnews.org/live. And I'm on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Catherine Hayhoe is director of the Climate Science Center at Texas Tech. She speaks tonight at the U of M. Her talk is called Climate Change, Facts, Fictions, and the Christian Faith. But you also gave a speech. Welcome. It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
You also gave a speech about whether we can change people's minds on climate change. Is there a short answer and a longer answer on that?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that was yesterday at U of M, and it was recorded, so it's on the IONE website. The answer is yes, we can change some people's minds, but not all.
Why?
Well, there's a really interesting study called The Six Americas of Global Warming.
Wow.
These Yale researchers did a market segmentation analysis where they asked people a lot of questions and based on people's answers, divided all of us up into six groups. So there's people who are alarmed and concerned about climate change. There's people who are cautious and disengaged. And then there's people who are doubtful and downright dismissive. Here's the thing. The voices that we hear from most frequently are the two smallest groups. Dismissive people and alarmed people are the smallest groups, yet they are the voices we hear most frequently. And so often we feel like we need to respond to the dismissive group. But people in the dismissive category, which includes Senator Inhofe, for example.
With his snowball on the Senate floor.
Yes, they're there because it's part of their identity to disagree with the reality of climate change. And so people in the dismissive group will not be convinced by facts or reason. They will not be convinced by appealing to a shared values. They would hardly even be convinced by a new set of angels from heaven with tablets of stone saying global warming is real. But that doesn't mean that there isn't hope, because about 90% of people in the United States are not in that category.
I feel like when you say, quote, we hear from, you mean primarily the media goes to those voices because they are vociferous, loud. They make their arguments probably pretty concisely. Is that what we're talking about? Media plays a role in this.
Not just concisely, but very in a very concrete way. I mean, bringing that snowball onto the Senate floor and saying, look, there's a snowball. How can you talk about global warming? Is a very compelling visual image. But when you actually get into what Senator Inhofe has said to other people.
Oh, yeah. I've watched a lot of YouTube video on this. Yeah.
He talks a lot about the role of God in, you know, how could we be so arrogant as to assume that we little humans could be changing what God has created. But he is a perfect example of how both scientific uncertainty, you know, oh, it's snowing outside, it can't be global warming, and religious sounding language, God wouldn't let this happen, are being used all the time as a smokescreen to hide the real reason for rejection of this issue.
Smokescreen how?
It is a smokescreen because Senator Inhofe himself said in a very revealing interview with Rachel Maddow a few years ago, he said, I used to be on your side of this issue when I first chaired the Senate Committee on the Environment until I read a bunch of papers saying it wasn't real, not until I read the Bible saying climate wasn't changing. He said, I was on your side until I found out how much it would cost to fix it. But that doesn't sound very politically appealing to say, well, sure, it's a real problem, but I don't want to fix it. It sounds a lot more acceptable to say, well, I believe in a God that wouldn't let this happen. Or those scientists are just faking the data for their own personal gain. That's a lot more acceptable.
I'm concerned that you're cherry picking Senator Inhofe, you know, one, because he does make his arguments pretty vociferously that just as you alluded to, that the Bible says this and we are people caught in a larger plan. And why would we ever think that we can alter that plan?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when he says, you know, once to Rachel Maddow, well, it's going to cost a lot. Okay, wait, no.
Sorry.
What were you going to say?
No, he is an example, but he is no more than one example.
Okay.
I love social science. I'm a physical scientist. I come originally from a background of physics. But I love social science because it can ask those tough questions. It is totally true that when we look at public opinion polls saying, do you think climate is changing due to human activities? And we look at people's answers and we divide it out by religious affiliation.
Okay.
White evangelicals and white Catholics are at the bottom of the list in terms of the groups that least agree. And I myself am a white evangelical, so I come from that tribe. But what social science has done is they've said, okay, is that a correlation that is causing this rejection? Or is it a side effect? And it turns out it's a side effect.
Wow.
Because when we look at all of the different factors that determine our opinion on climate change, there is one factor that is the number one predictor of what we think about climate change. And that is not religion. It's not where we sit on a Sunday. It is where we fall on the political spectrum.
Okay, so you're saying that was revealing when he talked about economics, right? And spending. You're saying that's why that is particularly revealing.
Yes. And in fact, the big issue, I think, is the role of government in people's lives. Because when you look at the solutions that we have been presented with at the national scale to this issue of climate change, solutions have been primarily presented by Democrats because they're the only ones who think we need a solution. And those solutions involve government legislation, what people perceive, at least where I live in Texas, what people perceive to be interference with our personal liberties. They involve, you know, the dirtiest three-letter word in the American language, which is tax. And those are the same things the American Revolution was fought over. So no wonder people are saying, I reject those solutions. But it's a lot more acceptable to say it isn't a real issue than to say, sure, it's real, but I reject all the solutions.
Okay, I got it. Pretty convincing there. Let me grab a call to Kurt in Scarville, Iowa. Hey, Kurt, hi.
Hi. Glad to be on the show, listening to you guys. My comment was that a lot of evangelicals, they tend to be conservative, kind of on the political spectrum, and they see the green movement as really kind of like a watermelon. It's green on the outside, but it's red on the inside, and that's a problem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's right, Catherine?
Oh, it absolutely is. In fact, I would take you and go one further, Kurt. I would say that I am often assumed to be an earth-worshipping pagan when I talk to Christian groups. And that is exactly why when I do talk to many conservative groups, which I spend a lot of time doing, I go in with the intention to break the narrative, because the narrative is that people who are concerned about climate change are false prophets worshiping a false god or goddess in the earth. And so I go in with a statement of faith. I believe that God created this amazing universe that we live in. I believe that God gave it to us to have responsibility over. And I believe that we are to love others as we have been loved. And when we start from that perspective, then all of a sudden people who never thought they would ever agree with you are nodding along saying, yeah, that is in the Bible. Yeah, I do agree with that. And all of a sudden you're two steps further down the path than you would have been.
Catherine, is this why you say that you believe that facts are not enough? You can't just walk into those gatherings and say, now I'm going to show you all the reasons that you should believe in the science.
Absolutely. In fact, again, the social science has tested the question of whether people's lack of scientific understanding is responsible for this current divide in public opinion. And they've showed conclusively that no. In fact, people who are the most scientifically literate in our society in general are most polarized on the issue of climate change.
So what do you say when people are nodding along in these gatherings where you're referencing the Bible, and it gets to the politics of this, and someone raises their hand and says, well, Al Gore is the one that started this, and he mm-hmm. was a Democrat, and why should I believe anything that the Democrats want to do? Because my political agenda is totally different than theirs.
Absolutely. What I do is, first of all, start by bonding over genuine shared values. So faith is a huge value that many of us share, but in other cases, it might be the sense of place where we live that is a shared value. We love and we're concerned for the place where we live.
So if you're in Texas, you're talking about the beauty of the landscape in which you live, in the state that you live in.
And
really.
Water availability, okay. And we're always worried about drought and flood. Texas is a land of extremes. So if I'm talking to water managers, I start off by talking about water scarcity. If I'm talking to people living in cities, we talk about floods. Then talk about how these things are already changing in our personal experience. So what is it that we are witnesses to in the years we have been in this place? Then say, and here is why I, more from my heart than my head, here is why I am concerned. I am concerned because of this value that we share, because of these changes that we are all witness to. I'm concerned about this issue, and here's what we think will happen if we don't make different choices. But then the most important thing to do is to end with solutions that are compatible with our values. Solutions like investment in technology, conservation, growing the local economy, solutions that people can buy into that are not branded as being from one side or the other of the political spectrum.
I think this gets to something that Michael in Buell called to say. He likes the fact that we're talking about this and that Krista Tippett talks about it. And he says, I heard Senator Inhofe talk about the book of Galatians, and I thought it was pretty crazy to quote the Bible when you're talking about public policy. You'd say, no, that is the way in to some communities.
Yes, to communities, not necessarily to public policy.
Right.
But it is absolutely the way in to people who have been told, and this is one of the biggest myths I think all of us have bought into across the entire country, we have been told that we can only care about climate change if we're a certain type of person.
Uh-huh.
If we are a Christian, especially a conservative Christian or evangelical, if we are Republican, if we live in the red states down the middle of the country, we have been told that we can't be who we are and care about climate change.
And yet you have someone like John Huntsman who says, but yes, you can, and basically, you know, survives three primaries and then has to drop out in the 2012 race. If people are hungry for this, Catherine, as you're saying that they are, why doesn't a candidate like that get more support?
Exactly. I have learned a lot from political science. And one of the biggest things I've learned is that, unfortunately, more people show up to vote, especially in the primaries, out of fear than out of hope. And when we look at this issue of climate change, the fear is coming from people saying, if it's real, it means an end to our way of life.
They're the alarmists in that Six Americas.
No, actually, they're the dismissives.
They're the dismissives.
The dismissives are using fear to say the government will come in and it will set your thermostat. It will tell you what type of car you are or not allowed to drive. It will dictate every aspect of your life to you. You will pay horrendous taxes. Your quality of life will decrease. Fear is being used against action on climate change.
So the alarmists are the people saying it's all real and the sky is falling. And
yes.
Got it.
And that fear is not motivating many people to vote, but fear on the opposite side is. Whereas the message I really feel is important is one of hope. Because hope doesn't paralyze us. It encourages us towards long-term sustained action, which is what we need. We need long-term sustained action. But hope doesn't make people show up at the voting box in the primaries.
Catherine Hayhoe is with us. She's director of the Climate Science Center at Texas Tech. You can hear that she spends a lot of time talking to evangelical groups about climate science and basically has told us this morning you don't lead with the science when you go in to talk to these communities about caring about climate change. My question for you, by the way, she speaks tonight at the U of M. There's more information on our page about her speech. But my question for you as you listen is, when you get into a discussion with someone who doesn't believe in climate science or perhaps is skeptical, you know, somewhere in that middle between the alarmists and the dismissives.
Mm-hmm. Doubtful.
There's a lot of Americans in there. So you get into a conversation with some of these people. Do you use gentle persuasion? Do you use some of the techniques that Catherine is talking about this morning? Do you hammer them with facts and then walk away and throw up your hands and go, well, my job is done here. And if they choose not to believe, what am I going to do about it? Talk to me about how those conversations go. 651-227-600-800-242-2828 on our live page. And I'm on Twitter at Carrie NPR, where a listener says, of course, the climate change solutions don't actually solve the problem, as UN's own models predict. Discuss those facts.
Let me make a guess as to what that person is referring to. That is, of course, the curse of Twitter.
Yeah.
Is the fact that we're limited.
140 characters.
We are. And I'm on Twitter myself, too, under K Hayhoe. So I am going to guess that that person is referring to the Clean Power Plan. Because the Clean Power Plan is what the president is trying to put in place to reduce carbon emissions from power plants. And it is true, by itself, on its own, in complete isolation, the Clean Power Plan will not fix climate change. It's like saying, you know, I have a health problem that requires me to eat differently. Turning down one hamburger is not going to fix my health problem. If I smoke and I need to stop smoking because I have a health risk from that, turning down one cigarette is not going to fix my health risk. But we all know that at some point you have to turn down the first cigarette. At some point you have to make that first choice. And what many of us don't realize is that other countries are moving ahead, far ahead. China, which has terrible air quality, mm-hmm. Our picture of China is incredible smog. You know, a new coal power plant a day is kind of the image we have in our head. But what we don't realize is things in China are changing very rapidly. Last year, China cut their coal use, but they increased their wind and solar even more so that they have the most wind and solar production of any country in the world, more than the entire European Union put together.
This is something President Obama talks a lot about. Are we going to cede the green technology domination, I guess, to China? And at the moment, yes, I guess we are.
And so you would think that from a conservative economic perspective, we don't want another country to take away the leadership in a technological area, one that is the future. The green energy economy is the future. I mean, I live in Texas, where wind is growing by leaps and bounds, not because people are a bunch of tree huggers. There aren't a lot of trees down there to hug. It's because it makes economic sense.
Let me take a call here from Josh in Henderson. Hey, Josh. Hi.
Well, hello there.
Hi. What do you want to say?
Sure. Well, I wanted to talk about how I communicate with some folks around here.
Good.
I'm in kind of an outstate community, not too far from the metro. So it's pretty politically mixed and diverse here. But I'm an organic farmer, and I also have a degree in, conservation and ecology. So, you know, I just buy the science. But a lot of the farmers around here are more of the, you know, maybe religious, conservative, political types. And, you know, on the surface, they might tell me that, I know it's just a, you know, conspiracy or whatever. But I do start out by finding common ground. We chat about the weather. We chat about community issues. I'm from here, so I know these people.
Mm-hmm.
And so that helps break the ice. And then we start to talk about all of the flooding that's happened in Henderson the last few years. And they start to admit, yeah, boy, I've never seen it like this. And then I point out, gee, you've said that every year now for 5 years. You've mm-hmm. never seen weather like this. And they start, that helps me communicate with them. And I think they're starting to see evidence of climate change in the weather like it or not.
Josh, you're getting the you go guy from Catherine here. That
yes.
is the way to, is he initiating conversations that might be persuasive long term in his own community?
Absolutely. That was a perfect example of how to bond over shared values and shared experiences, then connect those shared values and shared experiences to the issue of a changing climate, and then further go on to talk about what are ways that we can work together that are compatible with our shared values, our sense of place, the things we care about in our community. What are some ways that we could work together to solve this problem? Because again, we know that if we as humans are presented with a challenge or an issue or a problem of any type, but we're not given the option of pitching in to help fix it, we feel terrible. In fact, we end up often saying, oh, well, that can't be a real problem, because we feel like we can't be part of the solution. So solutions are very essential to this conversation.
I'm interested in where you think some of the evangelical leaders are. Someone like Rick Warren, who I want to play you an excerpt of what he said about this. Are they leveraging their influence with their congregations and their followers, in a way that you think really makes a difference? Let's listen to Warren first, and then we can talk about that.
Well-meaning and good scientists have differences on that. Regardless of where that comes down, as a believer in Jesus Christ, as a follower of the Bible, I believe we have a stewardship to take care of the earth. That is a spiritual issue, that we need to take better care of the earth.
So you probably agree with the second part of that, and we'll talk about that. What about when he begins by saying well-meaning scientists have a difference on climate change? He's still giving people permission to believe that science is not cohesive on this, and it is.
Yes, and in fact, researchers at George Mason University study messaging. They study what is the most effective one thing you could say that would change the most people's minds across the whole spectrum of the six Americas of global warming that we talked about. If you had 30 seconds in an elevator, they asked the question, what's the most effective statement you could make that would appeal to the most people? And the most common shared message was the simple message, scientists agree. Depending on how you ask the question, how you do the survey, whether you ask for people's opinions or you look at the scientific literature, study after study has found that between 97 to 100% of scientists agree not only that climate is changing, but that humans are the main cause.
So when you hear that from someone who's influential like Warren, what do you think?
He is essentially, like you said, giving people permission to say, your opinion is the same as my fact. But the reality is that, as a scientist once said, you know, scientists don't sit around on Sundays holding hands singing, yes, I believe in gravity. You know, whether you believe in gravity or not, you step off the cliff, you're going down.
Right.
So there are certainly opinions and facts, and there is faith and there is science. They are not the same thing. We need them both. But whether we believe in the science or not is almost irrelevant to the consequences. It's not irrelevant to deciding what to do about it, but it's irrelevant to whether climate is changing. It is. And so one of the first things I say to people often when I'm talking to groups that I know are concerned about this idea of it being a false religion, one of the first things I say is, I don't believe in global warming. And when I say that, you can see people kind of say, what?
What you doing here then?
Thought
we were going to get a lecture on why we don't believe in climate change.
But I don't. And that's what I'm going to talk about a little bit tonight is when we look at the definition of belief or faith, it is based on spiritual apprehension, not physical proof. When we look at science, it is looking at the physical world through observing and experimenting. So I don't think that climate change is something to believe in. I look at the data, I look at the information, I look at the facts, and it is the most logical conclusion.
That's really powerful. So when you say, what you're essentially saying is believe is not the right word for this. I know the globe is warming. I know climate science is real. Now, let me come to you with kind of what you've been hearing and how you feel like this has been so politicized. And that's where it gets more complicated, I would assume, in your talks.
It does. But I think talking about belief is important because what we believe comes from our hearts more than our heads. And what we believe informs both our perspective on these issues as well as what we think is the right solution or the right action to take in response.
Call here from Derek in Plymouth. Hi, Derek.
Hi, interesting conversation this morning.
Thanks.
And is possibly the one global
warming skeptic you might have on today.
That's okay. Good.
The thing that struck me is, and it struck me all along, is it comes down to a matter of trust. Who do you trust on the issue? Who do you trust to tell you information? Who do you trust to give you important facts? And I think facts are important, but who do you trust to give you important facts and the interpretation of those facts to make huge decisions, right, about, because it's not just a matter of, oh, now everyone agrees that there's a problem. The solutions being put forward are these global industrial scale solutions that, you know, micromanage economies and carbon footprints and GPSs and cars, and you look at options and people say, well, this will affect my life, whether you think it's scaremongering or not. So when I listen to the facts and I listen to NPR because I want to get both sides of all stories, and that's where I go for some of my information, then I go to a guy like Mark Stein and I hear about the 17-year global pause on temperature on the Earth's surface, and I say, well, gosh, I haven't heard much about that, even though people do talk about it. Or I hear Judith Curry, who's a well-known, respected scientist, point out that there are some holes in this idea that global warming is caused explicitly by human activity, and maybe it has something to do with the sun, which you would think as an energy source in our solar system could be a huge contributor to global warming and global climate change, and that the fact that the climate does change. There's the Little Ice Age, and there's other things that scientists can point to. So, again, the conclusions are where the trust comes in, and you might get people to say, yeah, maybe it has gotten a little bit warmer.
I'm glad, Derek, I'm glad you called. I want to give Catherine a chance to respond to a number of your points there. Catherine?
Mm-hmm. I am glad you called, too, because you brought up so many important issues. So, first of all, we often do hear a lot of science-related objections that you just referred to. You referred to quite a few of the ones that we hear all the time. I hear them myself when I turn on the radio or the TV. I have a tremendous advantage, I have to confess, because I don't have to make those trust decisions. I actually get to look at the original data myself. I can plot it myself. I can make my own decisions, but many of us can't. And sadly, when we ask people in this country, do you trust scientists? It turns out that how much we trust scientists depends on where we fall on the political spectrum, which is incredible. I mean, you would think how much you trust your accountant or how much you trust your physician, that shouldn't be a political issue. But somehow how much we trust scientists has become political, which I think is tragic, especially as a Christian, believing that scientists are studying what God was thinking when, you know, when this world was made and designed the way it was. I mean, if you think, you know, if you're a Christian, you think that that's what science is, and how could you not trust the people studying it? So in terms of the science, we do hear all of these things, but they are smoke screens. They are leaky sieves that fall apart if we look at the evidence. The problem is often we just hear the juicy soundbite from, you know, the congressional hearing or the quote in the newspaper. We don't take the time to dig in and find out, gosh, that thing's full of holes. What 17-year-old pause? You don't hear about that because when you look at the data, it isn't even there. So where do we go for answers? If we're looking for answers on the science, the best resource I can point people to is a website called Skeptical Science. Skepticalscience.com has answers to all these questions. How do we know that climate is changing? Is it just satellites and thermometers, or is it, as it is, 26,500 indicators from plants and animals and sea level and glaciers from around the world? How do we know it isn't the sun or a natural cycle? Well, guess what? Scientists have been asking those questions for 200 years, and we have answers. And Skeptical Science documents those answers very carefully with data, with references to scientific publications, with even sometimes the original figures, you can plot it yourself. These are good questions, but we have answers to those questions. And if we are going to be making decisions that affect us, our community, our kids, and our brothers and sisters around the world in profound and even potentially dangerous ways, and if we genuinely have questions about the science, I think we genuinely have a responsibility to seek truth rather than just accepting what we're told.
Catherine, I also don't want Derek to miss what you said earlier about often the policy solutions for this influence the way people will see the science. And you said, and you heard him saying GPS and industrialization. He went very quickly to, because I don't want the government intruding in my life for the solutions. Will you kind of repeat some of what you said about that?
Absolutely. Thank you for bringing that up. So, Derek, we certainly don't want to psychoanalyze you at all. But I would say from the people that I've talked to, and I've spent quite a bit of time talking to people about this issue, you're right. Our real objection, if we're going to be honest with ourselves, really look into our hearts, our real objection is not actually with the science, because it's science that's 200 years old. It's the same science we use in climate models as we use to design airplanes. And we all get into airplanes all the time. It's not really a problem with the faith part, because the idea of stewardship and responsibility and care for others are very core Christian values. It's because we've been told, and I like this word Derek used, we've been told it involves the government micromanaging our lives. And if you haven't seen the Lego movie, the micromanagers in the Lego movie give us a great example of how much we hate being micromanaged. So that is why the solution discussion is so important, because personally, you know, I'm not an economist. I'm not an expert in policy. I'm just a physical scientist. But as a person, as a human, if I could wave a magic wand and do one thing to fix climate, it would not be industrial solutions. It would not be picking winners and losers. It would not be government mandates on my life. It would be putting a simple price on carbon that reflects the price we're already
paying. The carbon tax.
That is refunded to people through their taxes. Uh-huh. They've had it in British Columbia since 2007, and people's taxes have dropped like a rock, which is pretty amazing in Canada. The economy has flourished, and what has that done? It is the opposite of micromanaging. It has freed up the free economy to do what it does best. The free market is figuring out how to balance the true costs and benefits.
Let me grab a call here that I think goes to what you've just said, to Al in Eden Prairie. Hi, Al.
Good morning. Great Hi. Conversation again. I would definitely not consider myself anywhere near the conspiracy theorist, but I am seeing some of the things when you mentioned about 10, 15 minutes ago about, again, along what you're just saying, the government managing it and such. I'm sorry to say I'm seeing it already. I mean, I think the carbon tax you just mentioned, I don't think it's realistic, at least in the next X number of years. It's just politically not going to happen. So what's going to happen, I think, instead is, well, pretty quick example, the Volkswagen crisis now, with the little bit higher NOx than was supposed to be allowed and the cheating scandals and such. Well, people are going, why are cars $25,000 or $30,000 and they get about the same mileage as they got 20 years ago with smaller cars? You know, yes, they're safer, but all these rules and regulations are causing prices to go up. And I just see that as a small example of a bigger trend. And I guess my concern is, you say it's not going to happen. And I guess, how do you speak to the faithful about that when they can look at so many examples and go, but actually, incrementally, it is happening. And that kind of worries me because, you know, like you say in other shows, the cost of living is going up and the wages aren't going up, and then you add the rules. And
yeah, I think we've got a good way to put this. And Catherine, what would you say?
I think you're right, Al. I think there is micromanagement. You could even make a case for the Clean Power Plan, for example, being a type of micromanagement. Why is that? It's because one entire half of the country's political process has checked out of discussing the solutions. And so that is why one of the few organizations that I do spend my time with supporting as a scientific advisor is called Citizens Climate Lobby. Why I support them is because they have one of, if not potentially the only, true bipartisan caucus in Congress today. They have a bipartisan caucus of 5 elected Republicans, 5 elected Democrats, who agree on a revenue-neutral carbon tax. In other words, the money does not go to the government. The money goes back to people, which is very important. They agree on that as a non-micromanaging free market approach. And we can only get to those types of solutions if we work together instead of being working against each other as we have been.
Catherine, this is why I started with Senator Inhofe, though, because not just to say he's a fool, he doesn't understand the science.
No, he does.
Because he sits in a very important position in Congress, and he represents, to some people, the voice of congressional Republicans on science. Contrast that on climate science. Contrast that with what you've just said. Are we really going to let all of these people check out of debating and enacting solutions? Well, then we get the paralysis that we've got right now. how do you turn that around? I mean, with a 10-person lobby in Congress.
I know. I mean, you have to look at it this way. 10 people's more than they had, you know, a year or two ago. It was zero.
Yeah.
So could things change? I think they could, because when you look at people's opinions, first of all, the majority of Republicans do think that climate is changing due to human activities. The majority do. It's just people's
case. You mean Republicans?
Yeah, okay. of voters.
Not in Congress.
No, not in Congress. But the conversations I have had myself behind closed doors with elected officials, I would, you know, venture a non-educated guess that between 8 to 9 out of 10 people who publicly say it isn't real behind closed doors, and I've heard them myself, are very free to admit, sure, it's real, but I'm not going to say it is because I wouldn't get reelected.
Catherine Hayhoe is in the studio this morning, and you can hear us talking about where faith meets climate science. She speaks tonight at the U of M. Our conversation continues. And I love it that you're thinking about where policy gets involved in the politicization of this issue. How do you persuade people in your circle, maybe in your own household, who don't believe in climate science? What are those conversations sound like? And have you had a success? Maybe you have a good friend who doesn't believe in climate science or didn't, and through a course of some conversations, you two have met somewhere on that. You can talk to me about that. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Of course, on Twitter, at Carrie NPR. Look at the latest news, then write back to your calls and your questions. Phil, what are you watching today?
Carrie, President Obama is pressing Arab allies to increase their support for the besieged Iraqi government as it battles the Islamic State group. Obama, who is in Saudi Arabia, met this morning with top officials from 6 Arab nations to address the conflicts in Iraq, Syria, and Yemen. The leaders will hold 2 more sessions. Iraqi officials have begun identifying bodies recently found in 2 mass graves in Ramadi. The city's mayor says 5 of the victims are a policeman and his family and 2 other security personnel. 32 bodies have been exhumed so far. On Tuesday, ISIS prisoners led authorities to the mass graves inside a soccer stadium. The Ethiopian government says its troops have surrounded an area in South Sudan where an armed group is suspected of holding 125 children hostage. The Ethiopian government says more than 200 people died when tribesmen allegedly attacked villages in Ethiopia last week. Ethiopia says it has killed at least 60 of those attackers. China's defense ministry appears to have confirmed a test of an intercontinental missile over disputed waters in the South China Sea. In a cryptic statement, the ministry responded to a question about whether such a test had been conducted by saying technical research within China's boundaries is normal. The flame for South America's first Olympic Games was ignited today in ancient Olympia in Greece. The flame lighting ceremony heralded the start of a 15-week journey that will culminate with the August 5th opening ceremonies in Rio de Janeiro. And there may be a candle lighting ceremony today on Queen Elizabeth's birthday cake. Britain's longest reigning and oldest monarch is celebrating her 90th birthday today. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:45.
You're still wondering where to find that great Thread podcast with Roman Mars? Just search Thread with Carrie Miller on iTunes, and you'll hear my just surprising interview with Roman Mars. The books that he loves, why he identifies with a single character in a great novel, why he thinks buying a bedroom lamp is going to make him so much more interesting. You can listen to it. Let me know what you think. Review it. Search Thread with Carrie Miller on iTunes.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by our members and by the Carolyn Foundation, working to support clean energy systems across the Upper Midwest. More information is available online at carolynfoundation.org. Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by Face Aging Minnesota, working to prepare people as our society ages and to transform the way people think about caring for our oldest citizens. More information at faceagingmn.org.
We're back to the conversation with Catherine Hayhoe. She's director of the Climate Science Center at Texas Tech. And when I talked about households, we remembered off air that she's got a really good story about persuading someone who lives in your own house that climate science is real. Your husband, How'd this work?
Well, I am a Canadian, if you couldn't tell already. And growing up in Canada, I did not know that there were large amounts of people in the world who didn't think that climate change is real, most of those living in the southern United States. Other countries don't really have a lot of people who say climate change isn't real or climate isn't changing due to human activity. So I went down to graduate school in Illinois. I attended Graduate University Christian Fellowship, which is a good Christian group on campus. I met my husband there. He was doing his PhD in applied linguistics, really smart guy. So I had never met anybody, especially somebody who was smart and educated and understood data and statistics. I had never met anybody who didn't think that climate change was real. But he, growing up in the South, going to a Baptist school, his dad was a Republican politician, he had never met anybody who shared his faith who did think it was real.
Huh.
So we were both so naive about this that we were about 6 months into our marriage before we figured out we're on opposite sides of the fence.
Do you remember what that first conversation where the epiphany hit that we do not share the same view on this?
Complete shock and disbelief.
Really?
Yes.
And then what happened?
A lot of learning, because each of us
you
had
to him to you,
both. Okay. Each of us had had these stereotypes. I had had the stereotype that only somebody who was uneducated would think that this wasn't real. And clearly my husband, you know, had a PhD in applied linguistics. When he was 27, he got an endowed chair at Notre Dame. I mean, you don't get that from being uneducated and not smart. So I realized, wow, he must have good reasons. I better listen to his reasons. And I better try to understand them and try to find responses or answers, because otherwise I should consider maybe changing my mind on some stuff. And luckily he had the same, you know, approach to me. He knew my heart was in the right place. He knew that we shared the same fundamental beliefs in God, the same perspective on our faith. And so he gave me that respect and that benefit of the doubt to enable us to converse. Now, it didn't happen overnight. It took months and even, you know, probably a couple of years before we were totally on the same page. And even still, we'd probably disagree over some solutions. And that's
okay. Right.
But we're together on whether it's real, whether it's humans, and whether our choices affect our future.
What if he'd never changed his mind on that?
That's a tough question, because respect is so hard. And so at some point, we all have relationships. You're probably thinking of your Uncle Joe. Or, you know, your cousin Tom, we do have relationships where at some point, if they're dismissive, we talked earlier about the six Americas of global warming, how we fall into six different groups. Luckily, my husband was in the doubtful group. People who are doubtful or disengaged or cautious can be moved, but people in the dismissive group, which is about 10% of people in the United States, and probably most of us have at least one dismissive relative, people in the dismissive group have built the rejection of the science so far into their identity that it is literally like asking them to cut off their hand or their arm to ask them to change their mind on climate. So there are some people in our lives, if they're dismissive, where we have to eventually agree to disagree.
To the phones to Heather in Minneapolis. Hi, Heather. How are
you? I'm good. How are you?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I resonate with Catherine's story about marriage, but mine was in a homeschool world. I found myself homeschooling for 15 years, and I was the only liberal, Jesus-loving liberal Christian in pretty conservative, right-wing groups homeschooling.
Oh, wow.
And it was really interesting. And I am passionate about this issue. I think it's as important as our national defense. And what I found, similar to Catherine, is when I approached these other moms with respect and we grew to love each other, we grew to trust each other through homeschooling. We had a commonality of wanting to teach and love our children well.
Right.
It was in that context that I was able to bring this up. And I noticed if I brought it up out of anger or I can't believe you're so narrow-minded, the conversation stopped.
Absolutely.
But if I brought it up in the context that was relevant to whatever we were talking about of seeking truth, curiosity, digging under, just like Jesus did, they were open. We had really good conversations. I don't know if I convinced anyone, but – I didn't get the door slammed in my face.
Boy, Heather, I'm so glad you heard this show and called. Because, I mean, Catherine can talk to a lot of groups, and she does that. But being influential in your circle, boy, that's key.
Yeah, too. And my daughters are, too. They're they're all for it. They're hysterical. They advocated for us to get solar panels. So we did, and they researched it, and they told all their friends about it and why, and so they're more vocal than I am.
Good to have your call. Catherine, I just want to repeat again, skepticalscience.com is a place that you recommend that people who are doubters or somewhere in the middle of the six Americas go for hard scientific fact.
Yes. If we want answers to the but what about questions that we hear every day, Skeptical Science is a place to go, because even though facts are not what will change most of our minds, at the same time, you know, our curious minds want answers. Now, if we're interested in solutions, solutions are a bit different. So solutions, we could go, for example, to Bob Inglis, who is a Republican former congressman. He has an organization called Republic N, E-N, for energy, who advocates free market solutions. There's the Nikiskin Institute, which advocates libertarian solutions to climate change. There is Citizens Climate Lobby, again, which advocates bipartisan solutions. So we do need to look at solutions that are compatible with our political ideology, but also, speaking this week, because this week is actually Faith and Climate Action Week. So for those of us of faith, which are almost 80% of people in the U.S., there's an organization called Interfaith Power and Light. It is not an electricity company. It is a faith organization that plays on the power and light from our lives, from our faith. And Interfaith Power and Light, on their website, they have statements and resources for every Christian denomination and for many of the world religions from leaders and from, you know, ministers, pastors, priests in our specific area, talking about from our faith tradition, why do we care?
I'm not sure you answered earlier when I asked you about faith leaders. We listened to Rick Warren talking about this. In general, should faith leaders, pastors, people that lead the kind of groups that Warren does, should they be talking more? I mean, should they be really assertive about this? Not just when they get asked about this, then they express their opinion. Should they be talking about it on Sunday morning?
That's a great question. So in our church, my husband is the pastor of our evangelical church, and his sermons stick very closely to biblical exegesis. So in other words, taking a passage from Galatians, for example, and walking through it. But the discussion of the social implications and the application to our lives occurs around those resources. So not necessarily in the Sunday sermon, but in the discussions that follow, in the small groups, in the choice of materials to study. In other churches, it's different. In other churches, social issues are part of the Sunday sermon. But whatever it is, if we really believe that it is core to who we are, to our identity, to not just take responsibility for the planet as if it were something different than us, we are part of creation. We are part of life on this planet. We couldn't live isolated in space without our planet to live on. If we not only believe that, but we also believe that love is a core characteristic that identifies Christians, as it says in the book of John, then today, how can we not express that love to others who are being harmed today as a result of climate change around the world? When we look around the world, the World Evangelical Alliance, representing 600 million evangelicals around the world, they were in Paris to advocate for climate targets. The head of the WEA was a member of the Philippine delegation. The National Association of Evangelicals here in the United States is led by Leith Anderson, a former pastor from this Minneapolis area. And they have a formal statement on caring for climate change is caring for the poor and the vulnerable. If that is the type of person we are, we must, our love and our heart compels us to talk and act about this issue.
John says on Twitter, be careful using China's progress on climate change as an example. China's government is the epitome of micromanagement because they can, right?
That is true. And I certainly do not, and I'm usually very careful about saying this, I certainly do not mean to say, oh, we should all be like China. Because I personally like the ability to choose how many children I have or don't have, among other things. But why I bring it up is because so many people say, oh, well, we could do everything we could to reduce our carbon emissions, but China isn't doing anything. And that is false. That is absolutely false. China is the world leader in wind and solar energy. We are not. And so we have to recognize that, yes, there's many differences between them and us. I'm not advocating doing it the same way as them. But we can no longer sit on our hands and say, oh, well, we can't do anything about it because China isn't doing anything. They are. And we need to make a choice to do it our way, or else we're not going to have that choice anymore.
We talked about your meeting your husband and your marriage and how his views on climate change changed. But I didn't want to end here without mentioning that your father was a scientist and a church leader. Is that right?
Yes.
What's his story?
So my father is a science educator. And we also grew up attending a church where there was not a single pastor who gave the Sunday sermon. It was up to the lay Bible teachers in the church to take turns. And my father was one of those people. So I grew up with the perspective that I didn't realize was so unique at the time, but now I appreciate it so much more.
I know.
I grew up with the perspective that if our faith, if what the Bible says and if what science is saying appear to disagree with each other, which we can't be naive, they sometimes do appear to disagree, it is because we don't fully understand one or the other, or sometimes both. And with a little patience and a little humility and a little willingness to accept uncertainty, we can proceed with both together instead of feeling like we have to pick sides. My father's perspective was that the Bible is the written word, and as others have said before, nature is the illustrations. How can they be incompatible with each other if, as Christians, we believe they came from the same place and the same person?
Yeah, I mean, this is why I really understand it when you say you came to Illinois, you really didn't realize there was such a division, as I think many of us have started to understand climate science and just take those divisions too much as the way it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not as, well, that's how our political system works, and there's always going to be people over here, and because they have their politics, they're going to be science deniers. This is not the way you have to live in a political system like this.
Yeah, we don't have to make that choice. And I think by recognizing that, it frees us up to be who we really are. And so being that this week is Faith and Climate Week, on my Facebook page, for example, I try to be more positive than negative because so much of the news we hear is so negative. So on my Facebook page, which is just my name, Catherine mm-hmm. Hayhoe, every day this week, I am featuring somebody who shares my faith, who is a Christian, and who is doing really positive, encouraging, exciting things on climate.
Catherine, thank you. This has really been terrific. You are very persuasive. Hope some some people that were skeptical heard you today loud and clear. Good to have you here. Please come back.
Thank you so much.
Catherine Hayhoe speaks tonight at the U of M. You can check out her Facebook page. You can also check out that skeptic, climateskeptic.com.
Skepticscience.com.
I'll tweet it out. I'll get it right. But check it out if you've got some questions about that.